issue that people have to get behind. There are moral issues that define who we are.
Well, Bill McKibben, we are going to do part two of our conversation after the show and post it online at democracynow.org. Congratulations on your address tonight at the new school.
It'll be good to be thinking of Jonathan Schell, who was one of America's greatest writers and a person whose counsel would have been useful in the Trump era.
Bill McKibben will be speaking at the New School tonight, giving the Jonathan Schell Memorial Lecture. Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, among his books, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. And we'll link to his piece in the New York Times, Why Dakota is the New Keystone. In 2014, Bill McKibben was awarded the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel, for his environmental activism. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Community Advisory Board will meet on Tuesday, November 15th at 5:30 p.m.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll have a special live radio play, Calvin Coolidge Goes Crazy, on Thursday, November 10th at 7 p.m. This live radio play is set in 1927, expanding on to the true story of Calvin Coolidge's decision in 1927 to not run for a second term as President of the United States. It also features songs from the era by Jerome Kern, Fats Waller, Cole Porter, Rube Bloom, and more. Again, that's Calvin Coolidge Goes Crazy, Thursday, November 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street here in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear more responses on the election of Donald Trump to the U.S. presidency.
Local high school students weigh in on the uncertainty of their future while also testifying on a measure that opposes fossil fuel infrastructure here in the city of Portland.
We'll get a live report from the anti-Trump protest in downtown Portland that's going on right now.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 10th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Tuesday's election was the first one held since 1964 without the full strength of the Voting Rights Act in place. The law was one of the pinnacles of civil rights legislation from the 1960s, but was weakened by a Supreme Court ruling in 2013. This allowed for some states to pass new voter restrictions, primarily in the South, but including Wisconsin, Ohio, New Hampshire, and other northern states. Most of these restrictions focused on voter IDs, but others concerned the last-minute movement of polling locations. The Supreme Court itself said that North Carolina's new voting laws disenfranchise black voters with, quote, surgical precision. The day before the election, a news release from the North Carolina Republican Party gloated that they had reduced early voter turnout among African Americans by 8.6%. It is not yet clear what effect the new laws had on the 2016 election results, but the Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition says it received 35,000 complaints related to voter suppression by the end of Tuesday. The complaints include voter intimidation, long lines, and uneven enforcement of the new ID laws. The part of the law struck down in 2013 had required 9 southern states with long histories of racism, segregation, and vote suppression to seek federal approval of new voting laws.
In the days since the election of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States, one of the groups he has consistently attacked during his campaign is preparing for an uncertain future. Muslims in America have heard all manner of insults from Trump since the beginning of his presidential run. He called for a temporary ban on Muslims entering the United States, which he later rolled back to, quote, extreme vetting, which is a fairly accurate description of the immigration process Muslims and people from Muslim-majority countries already endure. There are, of course, well over 3 million Muslims already living in the United States. They make up one of the most racially diverse religious groups in the nation. After vilifying them for months, Trump made little effort to appeal to Muslim voters in the way that he tried reaching out to Latinos and women in the home stretch. Cable reporter Sam Bowman spoke today with Arsalan Bukhari of the Washington State Chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CAIR, about efforts to repudiate Trump's threatening rhetoric and maintain a strong community of faith.
I think we can all safely say that we were caught a little off guard by what happened on Tuesday. What was the reaction within CAIR and within the Muslim community in the Puget Sound area?
You know, our response will always remain the same, that American Muslims deserve the same opportunities as all Americans to raise their families and their children. And we have, you know, sent a message out clearly to American Muslim children across the country that they have the right to the same hopes and dreams as every other young American. And we are really reinforcing and repeating the same message that, you know, they have the right to be fully American and fully practicing Muslims, regardless of any president. Our job is cut out for us, to be frank. We know that we have a lot of work to do, and we've known that for at least a year. So you might remember that 2015 was the year when we saw the highest number of anti-Muslim hate crimes ever in American history. In 2015, there were 1 to 2 daily reports of anti-Muslim hate crimes from some city in the nation to some care office in the nation. So we've known since 2015 that we've got a lot of work to do. We've got to make sure that fellow Americans come to understand the lives and challenges and contributions of their fellow Muslims or their fellow Americans who are Muslim. And, you know, when we tell our stories, when we have everyday American Muslims talk to their neighbors, that's when we see hearts and minds change, and we really have to do more of that in the coming months.
What sort of role has the youth played in this?
Yeah, well, the youth really are our future, and we're working to make sure that they're fully equipped to be the leaders of tomorrow. And what we're doing is to make sure that we're working with youth groups. Number one, to instill confidence among youth, that they, again, have the right to grow up with the same hopes and dreams as every other young American. They have the right to be fully American and fully practicing Muslims, like all Americans have the right to practice their faith. And looking forward, our job is to really make sure that they develop you know, leadership skills, that they excel in school, that they have access to scholarships, that they find careers that are fulfilling, not only fulfilling, but that give back to society. You might also know that 50,000 American Muslims are medical doctors across the nation, giving back and, you know, saving lives every day. And we want to make sure that youth know that there's careers out there that they can, you know, serve humanity as their faith teaches. But there are also careers in media and politics where American Muslims are heavily underrepresented, where they need to explore entering as interns and volunteers. So today we're telling youth that they have the right to the same hopes and dreams as every other young American. They have the right to be fully Muslim and fully practicing Muslim and fully American. Tomorrow, our work is cut out for us to help them achieve their dreams.
Donald Trump has been saying some pretty heinous things for months now. How has that manifested itself in the days since the election?
You know, again, what we saw in terms of hate crimes and all those things has been happening since 2015. We haven't seen any notable difference. So we've seen, you know, 1 to 2 daily reports of hate crimes since late 2014, in fact. And that trend, unfortunately, has continued on through 2016 and through this past week. So there's nothing that we can assign to the election results necessarily, just because we've seen that trend continue since the last 2 years. But unfortunately, you know, they're just as touching, just as heartbreaking. You know, when a mom calls you and asks whether it's okay for her to send her children to school the next day because of the elections, And our message, again, is absolutely. And, you know, parents need to tell their children every day that they have the right to the same dream as everyone else. They have the right to be fully American and fully practicing Muslim. Children need to hear those messages of confidence from their elders and from us.
Any events planned in the Pacific Northwest anytime soon, led by CARE?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're planning something for this weekend, and we're not sure exactly what it would look like, but something that's going to at least allow families and children to come together and really just sort of talk about how they've been feeling. I think that, in fact, maybe even overdue, because at least online and just through people's candid remarks on social media, you've really seen that people are nervous and concerned about the future, mostly because of the rhetoric of not only the presidential candidate-elect, but also many other lawmakers and many other politicians and media commentators. It makes them concerned about their future because it tells them that, you know, people in leadership positions think this way. And our job really is, again, to instill confidence in people that they should go on with their lives with confidence, with resolve. And for children, they should, you know, work to achieve their dreams. For parents and adults, you know, to go on and live the lives that they have worked hard to live. So we're going to come together as a community, and along with our interfaith allies, this weekend. We don't know what it would look like yet, but planning something for Sunday or Saturday. We'll definitely make a Facebook page, and we'll likely post it on our website and a few more organizations' website. It'll be done in coalition, so we'll have the other organizers also put it on their website. Our website is www.careseattle.org.
Okay. And I guess lastly, we talked about, you know, threatening behavior online and out in the world, but when it comes to actual policy, I mean, what could Trump actually do?
Yeah, and I think the rhetoric was definitely concerning. And again, you're absolutely right. Our focus now is going to be on the policies that will come from the executive branch. And we're working now with our allies in the ACLU, and with Muslim Advocates, with many other organizations to be able to chart the possibilities that may happen and then chart a plan on how to counter some of those possible, possibly unconstitutional policies that will come out of the executive branch. So our work, again, really starts now to plan ahead and ensure that we're able to challenge forcefully and, you know, on a principle-based system, any policies that are unconstitutional.
I've been speaking with Arslan Bukhari of the Washington chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For KABU Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The passage of the Multnomah County Measure 26-184 on Tuesday makes this county one of the first in the nation to set up campaign contribution limits in local elections. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader came to Portland to campaign for the county measure, which he said will set a precedent for other counties and states across the country. He also weighed in on the national election and how we got to this point.
So how did this happen? And elections are now entertainment, and they broke new ground this year. They've turned into a circus, and we have the chief circus barker, you know, Donald Trump, failed gambling czar, corporate welfare king. Cheats his consumers, his workers, his creditors, his suppliers, taxpayers. Doesn't know anything about the job he's looking for other than, believe me, okay. And then we have Hillary the hawk. Hillary's the candidate of more war, more Wall Street. She scares the generals. Look at her record. It's just horrific. I don't know where she came out of Wellesley. She was a peace advocate. And then I guess she decided, you know, her political career is good if she is the candidate of the military-industrial complex. They love her. The Wall Street moguls, they love her. She shoved aside Secretary of Defense Gates and got the White House to topple the regime in Libya. Gates said, what are you going to do next? You know, you topple, and then what? Are you ready? And, of course, it's imploded, massive violence spilling over into seven countries to this day. How'd this all happen? All this happened. I can give you a lot of indicators. They go like this on the graphs. You think unemployment is 5%, and you know how they figure unemployment. If you stop looking for a job for 6 months, you're no longer unemployed. You're, quote, out of the workplace. Like millions of workers like that. So the tough question is looking in the mirror. That's the real tough question. We want to be like the Democratic Party. They can't defend the United States of America from the worst Republican Party in history. And so they scapegoat the Greens. They blame the Greens for everything. You know, like Gore won in 2000 popular vote. The Electoral College took it away from him. Blame the Greens. Goes into Florida. 300,000 registered Democrats vote for Bush in Florida. Blame the Greens. Secretary of State of Jeb Bush steals all kinds of votes. We know the ballot shenanigans and misidentifying ex-felons deliberately and taking thousands of votes away. Blame the Greens. 5-4 judicial coup d'etat at the Supreme Court, blocking the Florida Supreme Court recount in Florida. Blame the Greens. Losing Tennessee, his home state. Blame the Greens. You see the syndrome? And they just can't get over it. They have to blame and scapegoat somebody other than their own corrupt selves. They can't get over it to this day.
That was Ralph Nader speaking recently in Portland.
And for more analysis on the election of Donald Trump, KABU spoke with Arun Gupta, independent journalist and analyst, earlier today.
This has been an absolutely astonishing election. You know, one of the things that's really incredible is the industrial Midwest, the bastion of labor support for New Deal liberalism, basically completely flipped to Donald Trump. And it did so by the thinnest of margins. But nonetheless, the fact he won Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio is just astonishing. But we shouldn't make too much of it because there's about 107,000 vote margin in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania combined. That is less than 0.1% of the national vote. And here's the really important thing to recognize. Donald Trump got a million less votes than Mitt Romney. He got less votes than John McCain. Hillary Clinton also got less votes than John McCain did in 2008. The real issue is she got 9.6 million votes fewer than Obama did in 2008, 5.6 million votes fewer than Obama did in 2012. This is the collapse of the Obama coalition and overall the Democratic Party coalition because they had the presidency for 16 of the last 24 years and screwed over the working class, white, brown, black. 2008 was what's called a wave election, right? You know, they got a Democratic supermajority in the Senate, 60 seats. They also padded their majority in the House. So that, yes, that's an outlier. And 2012 was more tightly fought, but Hillary Clinton lost, in terms of what Obama did in 2012, Hillary Clinton lost among whites. She had lower levels of support among whites. And she had lower levels of support among blacks, among Asians, among Latinos. That's extraordinary. She had less Trump got more support among Latinos than Mitt Romney did. That's how bad of a candidate she was.
And you have written also, just to wrap up, the cities, localities should be passing ordinances saying that they will not carry out directives of deportations of immigrants. And I wonder what you think of the California legislators putting out an open letter that that they will openly not comply with federal directives in that arena. And is this something that you consider localities across the country maybe willing to do?
Yeah, I think this needs to be a broad-based strategy for the left and progressives right now. And there's a lot to say about it. Part of what needs to be said is that the left needs to be more open-minded, be less dogmatic, be more flexible. You know, we can't afford to just stand on our soapbox and hector people, right? This is not a moment. We need to build really broad-based movements, but we also need to be clear about what we're trying to do. And I think turn cities, turn states that can be turned into bastions of non-cooperation, resistance, and protection for vulnerable communities. And that doesn't mean, like, we're not just talking about passing resolutions. We have to go further. We have to say we are going to take action. We are not going to cooperate. Directing city, county, state attorney generals and lawyer, the attorney offices to look, how can we gum up the works legally? What actions can we take? And people also need to be getting out in the streets and doing this as well. We will physically shut things down.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, journalist, contributor to The Washington Post, Yes Magazine, In These Times. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview about the election with anarchist organizer Scott Crow at 5:45. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be overcast, gray, and a little chilly during the day. The high of 62, which is actually about 10 degrees above average for this time of year. And then they expect it to rain. The low overnight will be about 54, which is also well above average. Today in history, in 1898, in what became known as the Wilmington Insurrection, white supremacist Democrats overthrew the legitimately elected government of Wilmington, North Carolina. It was essentially a combined race riot and a coup d'etat in which somewhere between 6 and 100 black people were killed. Thousands fled the city following the insurrection, which changed it from a majority black to a majority white city. It is considered one of the key turning points in American race relations after Reconstruction. It paved the way for decades of disenfranchisement of black people in the southern part of the United States.
It's now 5:21, time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Breaking news. An amazing new school for political activists is training thousands of people to be community organizers using Saul Alinsky's classic manual, Rules for Radicals. Called the Grassroots Leadership Academy, the school gives how-to lessons in everything from mounting successful protest actions to recruiting middle-of-the-road voters. Progressives need this, but wait, who's that hiding behind Saul Alinsky? Good grief, it's the Koch brothers. Yes, this grassroots outfit has been set up by the gabillionaire Koch boys to train cadres of right-wing corporatists to spread their ideological laissez-faire dust across the land. The academy is run through Americans for Prosperity, Charlie's and David's political wing, which put up $3 million to get it going. About 10,000 people have gone through some of the training sessions in 36 states. The brothers' grandiose scheme is to take over the Republican Party and use it as their tool to rebuild America itself into a Kochlandia ruled by the super rich. Even their money, however, can't overcome one huge barrier, their message. The Academy's curriculum, for example, is loaded with such corporate nonsense as a course titled The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Attendees were indoctrinated with two overarching lessons. One, freewheeling corporate power, unrestrained by labor, environmental, or other public protections? Good. Two, Social Security, unemployment benefits, and other social programs? Bad. This is Jim Hightower saying, Koch College for right-wing social engineers is peddling a status quo agenda of corporate elitism, which the vast majority of Americans are now openly rebelling against. It's like trying to sell chicken salad made of chicken manure. There's not enough sugar in the world to make people swallow that.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
In today's Portland City Council meeting, a number of students gave testimony on a measure to restrict the construction of bulk fossil fuel terminals here in the city of Portland. Here is some of their testimony.
Hi, my name is Peter Solinger. I go to Grant High School. Tuesday, November 8th, 2016, we elected our next president. In doing so, we elected a man who believes, among many other things, that climate change is a hoax created by the Chinese, and that because it was snowing in New York, we need global warming. We elected Donald Trump, a man who has refused and will continue to refuse to listen to the science that has been proven over and over again. And in a time like this, we have a tendency to panic, to say, what have we come to? And to walk away from everything we have been fighting for. But we cannot. For it is in these times that we must stand up. And as Hillary Clinton said on Wednesday, please never stop believing that fighting for what's right is worth it. Today we have a historic opportunity to do what's right and to walk the talk. We have the opportunity to show cities around the nation that we can make a difference, and that we will continue to fight for our children and our children's children, no matter who stands in our way, and that we will live up to the green image that people across our country conjure when they think of Portland. Today, we as Portlanders must take this huge step towards preserving our world for all those that will follow us. We will show everyone that Portland will not back down from leading by example, and that we are not afraid to make a difference. I hope that today we can honor those who will come after us by showing the world who we are in Portland. I would like to thank the mayor, as well as the rest of City Council, for leading the way and voting to ensure that Portland is safer and more environmentally friendly, and by showing our nation that despite setbacks, we will continue to fight for what we know is right.
My name is Sophia Smith, and I am 16 years old, meaning I can't vote. I am scared for my future because for the next 2 years, I have little voice in it. I am counting on this city council, who are the voice for our city, to act responsibly to protect my home and protect my generation and those after me. For we are the people who will have to live through the decisions we make today and in the future. 2 days ago, our country elected a president who thinks climate change is a hoax. What does that mean for the future of this earth, as the U.S. is the second largest contributor of fossil fuels and carbon emissions? Having Trump elected, I'm not only scared for the basic treatment of all Americans, but I'm scared if I will even have a future where I can keep fighting for human equality. We have so much power in our country to lead the way and shape our future. It starts with local governments who have the ability to take a strong position. Our window for stopping global warming is slowly closing, meaning why would we create this resolution if we are going to do less than we can? Instead of doing a second-rate job, which we have done so many countless times in the past, we need to do as much as we possibly can, so all of us have a future I am proud to live in. All we have time for is to take action and to do it right. If we weaken this resolution, time will run out before we have a chance to fix our mistakes. When you were children, did you think about the health of this planet and worry if you were going to have a future? Did you have to stand in front of your government just so your life would be protected? That is what I have to do, because my future is being put below the wealth of companies and endangering our planet. As a country, we need to realize the only people we want to help with a decision like this is ourselves. That means we can't weaken our actions. We have to do all that is physically possible. Last year, when the City Council unanimously passed this resolution to create a stronger regulation for fossil fuel companies and no new fossil fuel infrastructure, I was so proud to live in Portland, and I began to feel hopeful for my future. I want to live in a world where I am proud of the actions of our government and what they have taken so I can live a happy, healthy life. That can start here in Portland, Oregon, by standing firm on no new fossil fuel infrastructure or expansions. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Shannon Doyle. I'm 12 years old and go to Sunnyside Environmental School. I am here today because it is a human right to have clean air and water. I have grown up in this wonderful city. It's rainy winters and hot summers. It's beautiful masterpieces. The Columbia River Gorge has, in some ways, made me who I am. It taught me how to hike. It taught me how to fall. It taught me what my place is in the world. And most importantly, it taught me how to be myself. The Columbia Gorge has shown me how I am connected to every living thing. That is why we must do everything we can to protect all life. I recently read an article published in The Guardian about the estimated decrease of animal populations. In this article, Damian Carrington states that animal populations plummeted by 58% between 1970 and 2012. With losses on track to reach 67% by 2020. Researchers from World Wildlife Fund and the Zoologic Society of London compiled the report from scientific data. In 4 years, I will be 16 years old. In that time, if we do not decrease our fossil fuel consumption, more than half of our current animal populations will be gone, extinct.
In Portland last night, around 500 protesters shut down I-5 and I-84 and marched through downtown chanting, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA, and not my president." The Portland protest was part of a wave of protests Wednesday and Thursday across the United States opposing the election of Donald Trump as president. In San Francisco, more than 1,000 students walked out of classes on Thursday morning and marched through the financial district. In New York City, in New York's Washington Square Park, several hundred people gathered to protest Trump's election while a line of concrete blocks shielded New York's Trump Tower after 5,000 people, including Lady Gaga, protested there yesterday. In Washington, D.C., police put up security fences around Trump's new Washington hotel. One of the biggest demonstrations was in Los Angeles, where protesters burned a Trump effigy at City Hall and shut down a section of Highway 101. As well, young Latino protesters marched on Los Angeles City Hall Wednesday night, chanting, "I will not live in fear," and "Fight back, stand up." Several protesters said they feared that family or friends may be deported once Donald Trump is sworn into office. In Oakland, thousands turned out and fires were set, burning garbage and vehicles. Every campus of the University of California was filled with protesters, while students from the University of Texas in Austin marched to their state capitol. Protests were also reported at Texas State University in San Marcos, the University of Pittsburgh, Temple University, and the University of Massachusetts. Hundreds of high school students in Des Moines, Iowa, Phoenix, and Berkeley, California, walked out of classes and marched through the streets to local destinations. More anti-Trump demonstrations are planned heading into the weekend, according to organizers' online post, and one urged protesters to rally in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day, January 20th. And in Portland right now, a protest is taking place at Courthouse Square, Pioneer Courthouse Square. We are joined by Arun Gupta, who is live at the protest. Arun, what is the scene at this evening's protest?
I would estimate there are about 1,500 people out here tonight. This protest is being organized by Don't Shoot PDX. It's definitely very young, militant. There are all ages, but definitely a lot of young people. They're talking about the need to protect people who are under attack. They're going to start marching soon, and I'm sure we'll see roads and highways blockaded. And I seem to be standing in a cloud of marijuana smoke, but that's cool.
What are some of the signs that people are carrying?
A lot of them can't be. We can't read a lot of the signs over the radio. There's a couple of young women. One says that you can't comb over racism. Another is love, not Trump. Another is we will not be oppressed. Another one is a pussy grabs back. It says in a pussy cat, of course. So there's definitely a lot of handmade signs. I've covered hundreds of protests. This is clear. This is very much a spontaneous uprising. You know, people were shocked, and now that shock is turning into outrage and action.
What's the police presence like there tonight?
There is at least one police helicopter in the air. I haven't seen any police otherwise on foot. Last night, they were very hands-off. In a few instances, they were scooter and motorcycle cops that were blockading traffic. Going over the Morrison Bridge, I heard one scooter cop tell a protester standing in the middle of the roadway, please move, the cars are coming through. So unusually hands-off, as we know. You know, the Portland police can alternate between being hands-off and very violent, but part of the reason, I think, for the hands-off approach is people are rightfully angry, and plus we have a change of power in the mayorship, so that creates a certain tendency to not to overreact. either by Mayor Charles Hales, who's going out, or Ted Wheeler, who's going to be inaugurated next year.
And then what seems to be the main concern of the posters tonight? I mean, I'm sure there's many, but...
Well, you know, the fact that he got into power and all these communities are at grave risk. You know, it's clear that there is going to be some horrific policies that will be instituted against undocumented immigrants, against Muslims, against the LGBT community. Not enough attention was paid to the fact that Mike Pence is really just a fanatical evangelical Christian, anti-gay, anti-woman. So it's just the whole gamut of policies. But I think the best way to understand it that his win is really a declaration of war against cities. You know, cities are where you find the most diverse population. It's a space, some of the broadest space for LGBT community, for women. It's where the Black Lives Matter movement is centered. Obviously, lots of undocumented immigrants and immigrants of all types live in cities. And every group that Trump wants to attack is basically in cities. And so people here are talking about the need to defend, to make the cities an area of defense. Greg McKelvey from Doge Shoot PDX was just talking about that the city needs to stand up and defend these communities at risk.
Well, thank you very much, Arun. That was Arun Gupta, live from the protest in downtown Portland right now against the election of Donald Trump. Colorado voted on Tuesday to keep language allowing prison slavery in the state constitution. The constitution currently allows prisoners to be forced into unpaid labor and will not be changed. Hannah Lee Myers with Free Speech Radio News has more from Denver.
A section of the Colorado Constitution reads, "There shall never be in this state either slavery or involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime." And 51% of Coloradoans just voted to keep it that way. Amendment T would have eliminated any exception for the practice of slavery, making it unconstitutional to force prisoners in Colorado to work without their consent.
I do not think that one of Colorado's values is slavery.
Sharon Bridgeforth is head board member for Together Colorado, the campaign behind Amendment T, and she says confusing ballot language may be to blame for the initiative's failure at the polls.
The way that the initiative was written, I think a lot of people thought that they probably had to say no, and it was actually yes.
Earlier this year, the Colorado House and Senate voted in unanimous support of Amendment T, and at the end of October, not a single organization, lawmaker, or funding dollar opposed the anti-slavery legislation. The only minimally voiced concern with Amendment T was that it could have ended or challenged certain prison work programs. But amendment backers pointed out that 25 other states with no reference to slavery in their constitutions have functioning community service and work programs for individuals in the prison system. The failure of Amendment T means, in practice, Colorado inmates can still be forced to work and face punishment if they refuse. Members of the Amendment T campaign are discussing how to further their fight. However, considering Colorado has also voted to make it more difficult to amend the state constitution, it might be more difficult to cut slavery exceptions next time around. Hannah Lee Myers, FSRN, Denver.
One of the measures that passed in Oregon on Tuesday was a ballot measure in Benton County that will allow ranked choice voting in all future elections. Blair Bobiere, one of the chief petitioners of the campaign, spoke before the election on KBOO's Talk Radio about what this means.
It means that we as voters don't have to pick between voting for the lesser of two evils or feel like we're throwing our votes away. And here's how it works. If one candidate gets a majority, 50% plus one, of the first choice votes, they win. If no candidate gets a majority, then an instant runoff takes place, and that's another name for this. People may know it as instant runoff voting. And the way that works is the candidate with the fewest first choice votes is eliminated from the race, and whoever voted for that eliminated candidate, their ballot then automatically counts for their second choice. And to kind of put this in practical perspective, if people would think back to the Bush v. Gore election that Ralph Nader was in, no candidate initially got a majority, and if Nader voters had been able to use ranked choice voting, presumably they would have put Al Gore down as their second choice, and those Nader voters could have had their second choice count, and then the combination of the Nader and the Gore votes would have put him over the top. So that's how it works in general. In Benton County, we've put up a charter amendment with Measure 2100 that would use ranked choice voting to elect our county officials, basically our county commissioners. And in other places that have used ranked choice voting, more people have been engaged. It's resulted in more diversity showing up on the bodies that are elected by ranked choice voting, and campaigns have become much more civil and cooperative because candidates can't just rely on their own supporters. They would have to reach out to the whole spectrum of voters. They have to be looking for second choice votes as well as the support from their own supporters, so they can't really go and trash other candidates. They have to focus more on the issues.
That was Blair Barbier from Benton County speaking about ranked choice voting, which ended up passing in Benton County on Tuesday.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Wednesday, November 9th, 2016. A man dies of earlier wounds after being shot by Israeli soldiers. Meanwhile, armed tanks invade Gaza farmlands. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Medical sources have reported that a Palestinian man died on Wednesday morning from a very serious wounds he suffered in 1992 after Israeli soldiers shot him in the head during a military invasion into Al Jalazon refugee camp north of Ramallah in central West Bank. The sources said that the Palestinian Ahmed Mustafa Zaid, 44, was shot in the head from a very close range as he was leaving a local mosque in the refugee camp. He was only 17 years of age at the time of his injury. The bullet struck him in the head, leading to a traumatic brain injury and instantly paralyzing him, in addition to causing several ongoing complications until he died from his wounds at a hospital in Ramallah. Also on Wednesday morning, Israeli soldiers shot and seriously injured a Palestinian man after he reportedly attempted to stab soldiers in an area between Za'atara and Hawara military roadblocks in the northern West Bank district of Nablus. The Palestinian Red Crescent said that the wounded Palestinian has been identified as Muhammad Amir, 32, from Tul Karim in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. It added that its medics managed to provide the Palestinian with urgently needed medical attention before an Israeli military ambulance took him to an unknown hospital. Eyewitnesses said that the Palestinian man was trying to cross the road before the soldiers became suspicious of his movement and opened fire on him. In other news, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that Israeli soldiers have kidnapped Wednesday 22 Palestinians, including a journalist, during invasions and home searches targeting different parts of the occupied West Bank. 10 of those kidnapped were taken from the southern West Bank district of Hebron. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn Beit Hanina neighborhood north of occupied East Jerusalem and demolished a car wash building after surrounding and isolating the entire area. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan, Silwanik, stated that the soldiers invaded the area after isolating it since early dawn hours and demolished the car wash building that was built more than 4.5 years ago. Silwanik added that the demolishing was conducted without a prior notice. Elsewhere, several Israeli military vehicles and bulldozers invaded on Wednesday morning Palestinian lands close to the border fence in Khan Yunis, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, amidst sporadic gunfire to force residents out of their lands.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman and Yanka Soderberg. Our engineer is Matthew Olson, and the KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up Friday morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting. Guest host Linda Olsen-Osterlund will be joined from London by Andy Worthington, author of Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. At 9, Beloved Community speaks with the theologian Matthew Fox about his latest book, A Way to God, plus a candid conversation about ecology, human rights, capitalism, and resistance. At 10, it's Chris Andre, host of Air Cascadia, headlines, news, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Rabia Yemen hosts Digital Divide and takes your calls to discuss the WikiLeaks emails, disclosures, and what would happen if your emails were made public. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.